Here's the irony. Russia is fated for everything from its doorstop works of literature to the hardiness of its people. It faces no serious military territorial threats. Vladimir Putin is globally regarded as a more serious and statesmanlike leader than Donald Trump, not the highest bar to vault, admittedly. So why can Russia not avail itself of more soft power abroad? And why the Kremlin's constant refrain that it is a beleaguered fortress in a hostile, stormy sea? Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow's shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency, and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons, who also receive extra perks and bonuses appropriate to their tier. If you'd like to join them, just head on to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. But now, on with today's programme. Today, I want to talk about soft power and dark power, influence abroad, and legitimating myths at home. And I want to start, of all places, in London. Or should that be Londongrad? Last month, a heavily delayed report on Russian political interference was released by the Cross-Party Intelligence and Security Committee. The almost 10 months in which it had been kept under wraps had generated all kind of speculation and expectation about what it would say, especially about whether Moscow's interference had any impact on the 2014 Scottish independence or 2016 Brexit referenda. Needless to say, the report skirts all this politically explosive territory. In fact, although others differ, I felt it was a rather underwhelming document, heavy on a critique of the government and full of portentous generalisations, but pretty light on evidence or, more to the point, solutions. Look, I've written several pieces on the report, so I'm not going to rehash them all here, but I will include links to them in the show notes if you're interested. However, I do want to focus on this Londongrad point. The report devotes a lot of space to presenting the UK as a safe haven for dodgy people, welcoming with open arms all kinds of oligarchs and minigarchs, kleptocrats, conmen, corruptors, and ne'er-do-wells of sundry description, so long as they bring their lovely, lovely money with them. This is, of course, depressingly true. A willingness to welcome Johnny Foreigner, so long as he is socially agreeable and filthy rich, is, after all, an established British tradition. However, the report goes further and states that, and I'll quote, "The money was also invested in extending patronage and building influence across a wide sphere of the British establishment. PR firms, charities, political interests, academia and cultural institutions were all willing beneficiaries of Russian money." Now, to what end, you might ask? My question is, of course, where I went wrong and managed not to get my share on this Muscovite moolah. Ah, well. It continues. "In brief, Russian influence in the UK is the new normal." My God, I must admit, I'm so sick of the new normal, which has after all been deployed so widely during coronavirus pandemic times. Anyway, as if he were then determined to prove them right, Boris Johnson then went ahead and made Yevgeny Lebedev, the Russian-born playboy and press baron, and a long-time chum and political asset, a peer of the realm. On one level, this could be construed as a brazen two fingers to the Intelligence and Security Committee and everyone else expressing concerns about Russian influence in London. Londongrad. And yet, a seat in the House of Lords has, inter alia, long been a gift used to treat your friends, repay your sponsors, reward your cronies, and, if need be, buy off your critics. Again, Boris Johnson, if you're listening, bear me in mind. Lebedev is the son of Alexander Lebedev, former KGB spy and now an oligarch of liberal tendencies and pragmatic politics. Senior is, frankly, the one who earns the money. Junior, the one who spends it. But is there any evidence Lebedev has ever been an agent of Kremlin influence? He backed Boris for London mayor, to be sure, but unless you believe that the Kremlin plans and executes schemes of quite fiendish subtlety and brooding patience, and I don't, there's no evidence that this was ever on Russia's to-do list. On Brexit, Lebedev's papers pushed Remain against the prevailing Kremlin narrative that really quite liked the idea of seeing the European Union in crisis. And the people who work for him say that he's never really influenced with their coverage of Russia. Perhaps one reason why the ISC report didn't provide any evidence of Russian oligarchic influence on British politics is because what there is driven by arrivism, social climbing, personal ego and self-interest, not Kremlin mandates. Get invited to the right parties. Get off a speeding conviction again. Get planning permission for your three-story wine cellar over your neighbour's objections. Get your kid into Oxbridge or Eton. Get the regulator to give your share flotation or merger the nod. Get your mistress a work visa. Get into the House of Lords, even. You know, all this and more like it, I am entirely willing to believe. And also that comparable Chinese, Saudi, American, and yes, even British VIPs do exactly the same. But how does all this compromise national security? Ironically, I say that the real threat, and there is a threat, comes not so much from the Russians as the corrupt networks, the opaque financial institutions, and the tacit understandings that have evolved to serve not them specifically, but this whole demimonde of the cash-rich and moral poor. And, in a way, we should also recognise that these processes represent a means for Brits to siphon off these foreigners' wealth into their own hands, rule Britannia. But seriously, it raises the question, as conventional opinion hyperventilates about Russian influence, not so much how pernicious this is, but actually how ineffective. You know, what has the Kremlin actually achieved? In Britain, oligarchs drive up the price of palaces and penthouses and pay six-figure sums to play tennis with the Prime Minister. But policy toward the Russian state is, frankly, tough to the point of hostile. Likewise, there's all this furore about Trump being Putin's puppet. He's not. He's just susceptible to a strange but promiscuous case of authoritarian crush. But US policy towards Russia is nonetheless tougher than at any time since 1991. Sure, much that Trump does destabilizes America, dismays its rivals, and weakens the international order. But that's essentially Trump. Unless he's a cold, shrewd operative with masterful acting skills, this represents the clumsy opportunism of essentially a clueless narcissist, rather than, again, Muscovite manipulation. So the irony is that Russia could exploit any of the three different routes towards influence, all of which are open to it. But by trying to use all three, it fails at them all. And these three are, first of all, strategic influence operations through oligarchs and companies and such like. Secondly, soft power. And thirdly, dark power. So let me go through the three. The strategic influence operations, as I said, are in line with what I've already been discussing. The use of economic leverage, the presence of rich Russians, etc., to infiltrate, corrupt and suborn local politicians and systems. Now, I'm not saying that that never works. The cooptation of German ex-Chancellor Gerhard Schröder through the gas megacorporation Gazprom, for example, has indeed given Moscow real leverage. And yet, even then, if one looks at it, it's particularly been relevant over the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which has become a particular bone of contention between Berlin and Washington. Now, the reason why the Russians have been able to keep the Germans on side is, first of all, because there are many German economic interests involved. Secondly, that Berlin is really pushing back against what it sees as Washington's attempt to dictate policy to it. And thirdly, because it also suspects that America's extreme response to the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline is because, frankly, it would rather sell its more expensive liquid natural gas to Europe. So even when it is working, nonetheless, actually the Kremlin can use this influence only largely when it runs in line, in grain, with local political and economic concerns. One can also see cases in the Balkans that actually I want to get round to in a future podcast, though even there, such successes as have been made have been expensive and the result of a convergence between Russian and local interests. In the main, though, it's not proven that useful for Moscow. People like to see Putin's hand behind all kind of developments, but rich Russians, as I've said, generally lobby for the things they themselves want, which is less about the Kremlin's geopolitical goals than you might think. Actually, beyond regular expectations of tribute, whether it's donations to strategic courses or simple backhanders, and professions of loyalty, the Kremlin does not actually demand that much from its aristocrats. Perhaps it realizes how mobile they are and how eager they are not to foul their new nests in the West. It's not Russian corruption or conspiracy that keeps Western financial systems too often opaque and susceptible to dodgy dealing. It is not Moscow gold that makes politicians skimp on counterintelligence funding and press their police to focus on crime in the streets, not in the boardrooms. It's all on us, our greed, our hypocrisy, our short-sightedness, and our willingness to make compromises today rather than strive for something better tomorrow. Now, look, let me now climb off my soapbox, dial down my self-righteousness, and turn to soft power, though. Essentially, the power of example and good reputation. One that encourages other countries to like you and to want to be like you. The interesting thing is there ought not to be any reason for Russia not to have considerable soft power. The foreign ministry, especially its Rassotrudnicheство agency, which works with ethnic Russians abroad, puts a lot of emphasis on this. Then there's RT and Sputnik in the news space, and you know, beyond bears, balalaikas, and ballet, all kinds of more varied cultural exports, from Pushkin to TV series, many incidentally now on Amazon Prime, athletes to supermodels. In July, Gallup's annual global poll saw Germany rated as the most widely admired country. The United States came second with 33% approval. But that was only 1% ahead of China and 3% ahead of Russia. Indeed, a YouGov poll in Germany had 41% calling Trump the most dangerous man in the world. Putin, poor Putin, was way down the list at a mere 8%. Now, okay, these are just a few surveys. But we've seen that with events like the 2014 Sochi Winter Olympics and the 2018 FIFA World Cup, the Russians can also be welcoming, friendly, and win plaudits from not just statespeople and commentators, but ordinary people attending, or just simply watching these events. A survey of Brits, for example, who had attended the World Cup, found just over three quarters agreeing with the statement, "The Russians are our friends." Nonetheless, turn to something like the Portland Soft Power Index, and you'll find Russia in 30th place, 3-0, right after Turkey, with Uyghur repressing China at 27th, Amazon despoiling Brazil at 26th, and Europe's new authoritarianism with an entirely unfathomable language, Hungary, at 28th. So what's going on? Well, first of all, let's be clear that soft power and influence are related, but not quite one and the same. Soft power is exerted on below, influence from above. Ordinary Europeans, for example, may, in some cases, feel more positive toward Russia than their own leaders, maybe, or that they think that Putin is less dangerous than Trump. But unless they consider this sufficiently important to affect how they campaign and vote, all of this means is just simply some warm fuzzies for Moscow. Nothing else. It does not translate into policy. Every 6 months, for example, European sanctions on Russia because of Crimea, Donbass, and the MH17 shootdown need to be renewed, and renewed by a unanimous vote. Had this simply been in the hands of national electorates instead of leaderships, the consensus would have broken years ago, as countries such as Italy have shown a public that is only quite dissatisfied with sanctions. But when it comes down to it, any positive feelings about Russia are too marginal, frankly, to be the issue on which electorates can and will bring pressure to bear on their leadership. So this is very much just simply in the hands of the leaderships. Why are they more hawkish? Well, the answer is pretty obvious. For every earnest cultural attaché trying to promote the glories of Russian culture, there's a spy working at the same embassy aggressively launching operations against the host nation. For every genuinely perceptive real news story on RT, there's a piece of bilious and destructive agitprop. Then there are the state murders, the undeclared war in the Donbass. How do you build appeal on the exploits of your athletes when you're then found to have doped and cheated their way to glory? All countries' policies, frankly, are a mix of the altruistic and the selfish. Let's be clear about that. But the bad too easily taints the good. And for all the glitz of deliberate soft power campaigns, I still cringe at the cool Britannia one Britain launched a while back. They need to have substance behind them. There needs to be a substance that accumulated over time and through genuine commitment. Now, as I think the Chinese, for example, are going to discover with their Confucius Institutes and their often elephantine propaganda campaigns, you can't just buy lasting and meaningful soft power when the message is at odds with the substance. And here we come to dark power, and the way that one could suggest in this, the Kremlin is absolutely harmonizing means and message. But let's have a short break, and then descend into the murky realms of intimidation and unpredictability as policy. Just the usual reminder, you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. You can support it by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the show. When I talk about dark power, I'm thinking of something we could almost think of as the murky mirror image of soft power. It is influence through intimidation and threat, through being perceived as too dangerous to deny. Although I'm not sure that anything less than therapy and a truth drug will get the likes of Putin or Security Council Secretary Patrushev to admit it, the policies they enact suggest that they either have given up on soft power or, perhaps even sadder, they don't even really believe it exists. Theirs is, after all, a world of almost caricature realpolitik. A game of risk where every move is driven by self-interest and where gratitude, morality and altruism are moderately high-scoring Scrabble moves, if I can be allowed to swap board games. In this rather bleak world, a resurgent but still vulnerable Russia is under threat. Marginalised, scorned, treated as a second-class power. It tried, they feel, to play a role in the Western-dominated order. To let NATO expand to its border. They saw the West reshape the Balkans as it saw fit. They watched Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya shattered by American hubris and European fecklessness. And meanwhile, they were patronised as a regional power, lectured at, and frankly treated as an outsider. Now look, I'm not trying to say you or I need to buy into this particular view of the world. But it does behove us to realise that this is how they perceive and interpret the past 30 years. They're not hell-bent on undermining democracy for its own sake. They actually think of themselves as democrats of a sort, at least as representatives of the will of the Russian Narod people. They're not trying to bring down the international order. Frankly, they benefit from it. And their complaint is typically that this order is not strong enough to constrain US hyperpower. They don't have this kind of grand design. Anna Arutunyan has a good piece in Foreign Affairs about the limitations of their ambitions. Rather, they think the world is a pretty, if you'll excuse me, shitty place where you need to behave in a pretty shitty way to get anywhere, or even just to defend what's yours. And from this skewed and rather reductive perspective, their embrace of dark power makes a perverse kind of sense, even if I personally think it will come to be seen as a serious mistake. If you're already seen as the pariah in the playground, if you don't think you're going to make any friends, and if you fear becoming the target of bullies, then what is left but to become the biggest, baddest bully in the playground? The one no one will challenge. Maybe even someone other kids will look to, not because they like you, but because they hope that pandering to you will ensure you don't mess with them, and maybe even that your presence will actually ward off other bullies. Look, this may sound like a ridiculous metaphor to try and explain the strategic logic of a nuclear power, but it is not as though it is confined to the playground. Consider, for example, Chechen organized crime. Now, as I discuss in my book, The Vori, obligatory plug there, they constructed for themselves a truly formidable, bloody and remorseless reputation. Mess with them and you knew that they would escalate, that they would keep coming back at you, that they would call in their uncles and their cousins until they killed you, your family, your household pets. In short, they had and have a reputation for not being reasonable, for prioritizing retaliation over self-preservation. And what's the result? Well, the result is, ironically enough, that these Chechens actually have to resort to violence less often than other criminal groupings precisely because of the violence of their reputation. Someone who might, under other circumstances, have opted to try to resist criminal predation knows it's just not worth it when it's the Chechens who come calling. Their brand name is such that people just pay up or move on, and the Chechens therefore never, or less often, have to demonstrate whether they're still as formidable today as they were in the 1990s. Look, I certainly don't subscribe to the idea of presenting Russia as a mafia state. That's a journalistic cliche that caricatures more than it explains. Nevertheless, in a way, this is Russia's strategic ambition. To appear so ruthless, capable, dangerous, and downright unreasonable, except on its own terms, that its rivals and neighbours feel that they have to make their own accommodations with Moscow. Hence the stream of otherwise illogical acts. You know, why alienate Germany by having a not-so-important Chechen rebel gunned down in the centre of Berlin? Why, if you're going to try and assassinate a turncoat spy in the UK, do it with a nerve agent that can be traced to you, rather than something more subtle? Why persist with the hacks and the trolling, even if their impact seems questionable? Why buzz US ships with your own fighter planes? Wargame a nuclear strike on Sweden? Illustrate your new weapons program with a simulation of a launch on Florida, for heaven's sake? This is cosplay Bond villain stuff. Trying to look too bad to cross. This is dark power. And it's also a policy that is to an extent determined by domestic political calculations. There's no evidence that most Russians are especially hostile to the rest of the world, as I'll come to, quite the opposite. Nor are they particularly supportive of military adventures abroad. Everyone who thinks that the enthusiasm for the seizure of Crimea demonstrates some wider jingoistic spirit really has it wrong. They should remember that this was a one-off. It was a piece of territory pretty much every Russian, whatever their opinion of Putin, thought was rightfully theirs. And what's more, that it could be taken pretty near bloodlessly. Even the subsequent intervention into the Donbass had pretty much no domestic support, and which is exactly why the Kremlin continues to deny that it's there. If one looks at successive surveys by the Levada Center, which is Russia's best and most independent polling agency, the proportion of respondents describing the West as an enemy has, since 2016, fallen from 7% to 3%, which is in January of this year. The West as competitor, 24% down to 16%. Conversely, the proportion willing to describe the West as a partner has gone from 55% up to 67%. And perhaps even more strikingly, those who describe the West as a friend has gone from 4% to 11%. Now look, this doesn't work for the Kremlin, which, unable now to promise improvements in standards of living, which is frankly the true basis of Putin's approval ratings, has instead it switched to its often ludicrous characterization of the West as a vicious foe. In effect, they are trying to Patrushevize the population, and it's not working. But the Kremlin at present doesn't seem to know what else it has to offer. So in part, this provocative dark power approach is dictated by the domestic political line. Not least, when it provokes a Western response, that is then spun as Western Russophobia in an attempt, usually vain, to justify the legitimating narrative that the Kremlin has adapted. This is a depressing and ultimately counterproductive vicious cycle. But the clock is ticking, and I'll leave discussion of the long-term risks and medium-term limitations of dark power to another time. But while much of the Russian government machine continues to try and accumulate soft power, this will be futile so long as the Kremlin itself feels it must become a dark superpower. And in the process, its oligarchs essentially buy influence for their own ends. Its soft power agencies continue to spend money, but just to fulfill targets and meet metrics, not really making Russia new friends. And Russia's efforts to generate dark power may win some allies in the authoritarian world, but otherwise simply empower a whole industry of hawks, Russophobes, and information warriors who quite successfully make a meaningful shift of policy towards Russia politically indefensible. Of course, sometimes things work. Some influence can be mobilized by the Kremlin. Some soft power can tilt a political balance at the right moment. Some dark power can deter retaliations or paralyze the timorous. On the whole, though, let's be honest and acknowledge that the fiendish Russians are squandering both money and goodwill. And we must, in this process, not be stampeded into thinking that they are the unseen masters of the world. I, for example, would like to see a follow-on to the ISC report, and a rather more timely one. As a citizen, as a voter, I want specifics. I want to know exactly how this influence does indeed play out, if we are told it is the new normal. I want to see what kind of policies are going to be adopted to deal with it, ones that manage to balance a containment of the real risk with continued engagement to make sure that we don't play to Putin's legitimating narrative of Western hostility. The fundamental point is this: dark power operates because of fear, because of ignorance, and because of self-delusion on our part. Those are the real threats that we need to address. As I say, I'm not underplaying Russia. I do believe there is a genuine challenge, a genuine threat that comes from it. But if we simply present Russia as being this much, much more powerful institution, much, much more dangerous, much, much more smart, much, much more nimble, all these other kinds of things, we end up actually weakening ourselves. We end up playing to Putin's dark power. That old line, "we have nothing to fear other than fear itself," actually applies here. We need to be confident. You do not deal with a bully in any other way. Oh dear, though. Once again, I have climbed on my soapbox, and that means I think it's time to end this particular podcast. Thank you, as ever, for listening. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well. И только будь, пожалуйста, со мной.